Hey, listeners, we're nearing the end of our 15th anniversary fundraising campaign, and we need your help to meet our goal. This campaign offers you a chance to win a unique food and music experience in one of the most exciting cities in America. Here's how it works. Donate to HRN and you'll be entered to win dinner for two and two tickets to a concert in one of eight amazing cities: New York, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, Nashville, Las Vegas, Charleston, Ardmore, Pennsylvania, and Asheville. All donations support our work educating food system storytellers. And when you donate, you can choose one of those cities and you'll be entered to win dinner and two tickets to a show. So help us reach our goal and enter to win dinner and a show in the city of your choice. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15. Thank you.
Today's program was brought to you by Roth Cheese, a pioneer in the U.S. specialty cheese movement. For more information, visit rothcheese.com. This week on Meat and Three, we're getting semantic to understand the deeper meaning behind some of the foods we love. First, we'll look at the big debate happening around the word milk.
Who the hell are you to tell me what is the name of my product and my landscape and everything we've cared about when, you know, you don't have anything invested in except to put out a little money to buy it? It's our entire life.
Then we get the lowdown on the language of cider.
So the first thing that's really confusing about dryness is that it has nothing to do with how something actually feels in your mouth.
And finally, we get our fill of tiki talk.
You don't walk into a tiki bar and be like, oh yeah, this is what Polynesia is probably like. Like, it's supposed to be like fantasy and stuff. That's the hard part. It's so easy to do tiki bad, and that's where it gets a bad name.
Tune into this week's episode of Meat and Three. That's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host here on Heritage Radio Network on A Taste of the Past. And, you know, to learn about the food of a country, one really has to look at the culture and the history of the people in that place. In the past, the food of Italy, for instance, has often been reduced to a few popular dishes, kind of all lumped together and say, oh yeah, that's Italian. And even then, it was most likely misrepresented or misunderstood. You know, just think spaghetti or spaghetti and meatballs? Mm-mm. But we've come a long way in understanding the variations and the nuances of regional cuisine. And my guest today has definitely added her voice to that pursuit. She's Katie Parla, a well-known food and beverage journalist, a travel and culinary guide with an award-winning food and travel site, and I will add, a historian. More than just a culinary historian, she is a historian, evidenced by her scholarly research in the origins and backgrounds of the places and culture and food that she writes about. Her articles have appeared in a lot of publications. Some that you most likely would be familiar with are the New York Times, Food and Wine, Savour, The Guardian, Condé Nast Traveler, Eater. I'm running out of breath. Katie is the author of the 2016 award-winning cookbook, Tasting Rome, and it's so much more than a cookbook. Her newest book, that's just been released by Clarkson Potter, is entitled Food of the Italian South, Recipes for Classic, Disappearing, and Lost Dishes. Welcome, Katie.
Hi.
Again, this is so much more than a cookbook.
It's true, Linda.
It really is. But, you know, I read in there that, and I've known because I've known you for a while. And
so many years now.
I don't know. It's been quite a few, and you're a very good guest and a very frequent guest when I can nab you when you're in town or when I'm in Rome. But what drove you to write about the south of Italy?
I love the south. I often joke, and this will only be funny to people who know Roman geography, I never go north of Ponte Milvio. See, you get it.
Yeah.
I live in Rome. I've been there for 16 years. And when I have a day free, I hop on an hour-long train to Naples, the gateway to the south. When I have a week or a month free, I hop in a car and visit Molise, Calabria, Campania, Basilicata, and Puglia. I just really love the culture and the food in the South and a lot of the sort of ingredients that we associate with Italian cuisine. No, we know that there is no real Italian cuisine, but right. the sort of generic right. idea of Italian cuisine, like mozzarella, buffalo, mozzarella di bufala specifically, the use of tomatoes and eggplants and those types of things are more deeply rooted in the cuisines of the South. So yeah, I really like the food. I really like the atmosphere. And you've got these like incredible regions. Molise, which is just 2 hours drive from Rome, has far more livestock than people. And you can have real adventures when you go to that region, or any of the ones that I listed earlier, in a way that you can't if you're going to Florence or Venice or even my home, Rome.
It's all people.
Packed with people.
Those are all people.
Almost right? no sheep.
Yeah. And it's interesting because to me, because the dishes that have, I don't know, a little bit more soul, a little bit more character, all seem to come from the South. I mean, certainly, yes, northern beans and polenta, although you find a lot of polenta South too. But, you know, and of course now in the big cities, you know, Torino and Milano, they're big cities, and you get a little bit of everything, and you forget what city you're in usually when you're eating in those cities, but yet you go to the South and you really remember where you are, right?
Yeah, I mean, there still really feels like when you go to Naples or Bari, you don't have the same, I don't know, almost like diluted food culture that you find in Rome or Venice. People are still cooking the cucina barese and the cucina napolitana in a way that's much closer to the origins of those things.
And of course, the origins of those things, we talk often, and I talk often on this show, and I promise I wouldn't do too many more Italian shows, but I would branch out, but hey, I can't help it, you know. That it was widely based on the cucina povera, if even that is sort of a misnomer, too, in the southern dishes.
So yes and no. A lot of the things that we, you know, eat today in the south of Italy are really simple dishes, but that's because the cuisines, the regional cuisines of those places, sort of as we know them, took shape in the late 19th and early 20th centuries when the south was impoverished. Before that, you know, Naples and the environs were some of the wealthiest and most populated places in the world, like pre-Italian unification.
Right.
There were a lot of wealthy people in the South, and you still do see evidence of that nobility in the desserts, which tend to be like elaborate and with lots of sugar and colorful things that really do demonstrate how, you know, opulent the culture was before the economic devastation that was caused by the unification, immigration.
Yeah. Well, talk a little bit about what caused that the South to be so impoverished and basically lose all the majority of the inhabitants who all fled to parts like Canada and North America and America.
Yeah. So
Australia.
Until 1861, the South of Italy was under Spanish dominion. The Bourbons ruled. To get a sense of how immensely wealthy they were, visit the Reggia di Caserta, which rivals Versailles. And that, you know, the whole lower peninsula had a ruling class that was very wealthy, that was secular, and then also the clergy that was a really important landholding feature. And when Italy was unified, the Bourbons and, you know, the church and all the people that were running the real estate and businesses of the South were a threat to the unification of Italy. So the Turin-based king, who eventually made his capital in Florence and then Rome, his name is Victor Emmanuel II, implemented policies along with his successors that systematically destroyed the economy of the South, breaking up noble lands and church lands. And so people who lived off of the land often lost their means of supporting themselves, and many starved. Those who could afford it or organize themselves enough went to ports and departed at the end of the 19th century, mainly for the ports of the United States, and the economic devastation never, the South never really did rebound from that. And so when Italy suffered economic crises like in the 60s or, you know, in 2009, the South really did absorb most of that sort of devastation, leading to successive migrations to Canada, South America, all over South America, Australia, and of course the brain drain that we talk about when we speak of modern Italy. The South has a lot of university-educated people who have fled to Milan, London, places where there are jobs for academics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's interesting because the you mentioned, in fact, in your book, you know, every time you go to the South, to a particular area, you go, where is everybody? You know, it's still, I mean, now they are getting there. They didn't have their fair share of tourism for a long time. They really weren't tourist central down there. But now, certainly Puglia, Calabria to some extent, is becoming much more a tourist destination.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you want to choose one region that has really transformed itself deliberately into a tourism destination, that has to be Puglia. And European Union funds have been properly used to develop touristic centers, especially around Salento and Lecce, the Valle d'Itria, which is best known for Alberobello Bello and its Trulli. Bari has seen a real renaissance. And Matera, which is just across the border, is often...
And Basilicata is starting to build up quite a bit.
To a very small extent, only the two centers... Well, let's say three. The Vulture, which is the wine-producing area, famous for Aglianico, has some tourism. Bernalda has tourism, thanks to Francis Ford Coppola's Palazzo Margherita, which is, like, very fancy... not particularly accessible destination, like a boutique hotel. And then Matera, which also has benefited from European Union funds, private investment, local investment, and really is like a cool place to visit if one that feels inauthentic for the near absence of people living in Matera. the Sassi di Matera, which is that part. If you know Matera, or if you just like simply Google Matera, the first thing that will come up in an image search is this like nativity-like landscape called the Sassi, where people lived in caves until the 1950s and 60s when they were forcibly evacuated for the hygienic conditions. And now that's a place that people, myself included, go and like gawk at all the weird cave dwellings.
Yeah, interesting. You really held to, in writing this book and researching the cuisine, you held to the designation of the south of Italy and not southern Italy. You want to talk about that? Explain that.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to create a book that had a clear geographic delineation. Southern Italy is, you know, most everything south of Rome. So let's say like from Gaeta all the way down through the toe and the heel. Sardinia is considered part of southern Italy, Sicily, surely. But I wanted something that was more focused on the lower peninsula only. And the book covers Molise, Calabria, Campania, Puglia, and Basilicata. And I certainly could have extended, but that would have brought in Sicily, which would have taken up space better, in my opinion, dedicated to Molise and Basilicata, which have, you know, almost no literature about them, whereas there already are many wonderful books about Sicily.
Yeah.
And the South Italy versus Southern Italy distinction has its roots in like a very boring Italian bureaucratic definition.
We won't go there.
Yeah.
and also places like Sicily and Sardinia. I mean, you're talking about a whole other cuisine and a whole to a large extent. Or at least many of the specific dishes. So I think focusing on this was a wonderful thing. I mean, it's, you know, you keep it very, very specified, very unique. You talk of the process when you, I said earlier in the introduction that, you know, your research is always solid and solid by going and talking to people, finding out about what's going on in the region, as well as scholarly. I mean, you look up your, you know, your dates and the history and what's going on in the region. What was your process here, and how did you, who did you decide to talk to? Where did you go? How did you find out about so many of these dishes?
Well, I'm super fortunate in having more than 15 years of experience traveling to the South. And even before I was writing cookbooks, when I would travel, you know, like my friends or, you know, whoever I was traveling with at the time would go to the beach and I would go to the trattoria and interrogate people. Or my friends would go to the beach and I would go to the vineyard and interrogate people, taking notes always. And then when I was sort of more strategically researching for the book, I would go to markets and strike up conversations with vendors, ask them questions about their food memories, because a lot of the dishes that, you know, people think about when they think of their nostalgia for food, they're not talking about the things that are on the table today. They're talking about the things their grandparents made decades ago and therefore have either vanished and only exist in memories, or only made, you know, when the whole family gets together once a year, or if there are a lot of family members living abroad once every 5 years or 10 years. So it was, yeah, a lot of, you know, speaking to people about what they remembered about their childhood tables. Also looking at works of art from festivals, which were important during the time in which virtually everyone in the South was either a noble or a rural peasant. And when, you know, peasants were encouraged to party around, you know, important holidays. And then, you know, seeing if I could trace the origins of a recipe that appeared in a work of art.
Mm-hmm. A lot of these recipes certainly aren't, we're not talking about history. We're not talking about, you know, pre-17th century, really, because tomatoes are evident in many of the, and eggplant tomatoes, things that would be New World additions to the cuisine. So these are, I mean, people to think about their grandparents, certainly they weren't that old. But how much do you feel the cuisine is based on a lot of these New World or perhaps even other influences from other places?
Great question. I mean, there are some like legumes and pulses, prickly pears, certainly, tomatoes, certainly, different types of squashes for sure that arrived after the 15th century. But the origins of a lot of these dishes, if you sort of look at the ingredients list of a soup and there are 10 different legumes, some of which were, you know, coming from Asia, others that are coming from the New World. You do see sometimes like some families will add tomato and some don't. It's kind of like caponata in Sicily. There's some people who make it the old school way, no tomatoes, and some who use tomatoes. So you can really like imagine extracting that New World ingredient. And, you know, take a look through the book, and actually a lot of the stuff is indigenous. If you want to draw a sort of line at indigenous being like Greco-Roman times. So a stew with bay leaves and pork and grapes would have been at home.
One of my favorite recipes in the book, I have to say.
It's so good. And I keep saying like, oh my God, this is so delicious. But, you know, not because I, you know, wrote this recipe, but simply because I went to a place, ate this, reverse engineered it, and like someone else made this really delicious. I just
now
put
that,
it on paper.
And it's spezzatina all'uva.
See.
So it's little cuts of pork with grapes. Now, this is not really a disappearing recipe, though. I mean, that's around a bit, isn't it? I mean, do you consider that something that's sort of falling off the grid?
I wouldn't necessarily consider this one disappearing. It maybe doesn't have the critical mass that it used to, because in Molise, where this comes from, small family-owned plots where people harvest grapes and make their own wine have slowly been abandoned, as it's really hard to make wine.
Yeah.
And lots of Molisani have gone elsewhere. And when you visit Molise, there, you do encounter these like enormous vineyards making pretty low quality wine. And they're not like taking a lunch break and making pork stew with grapes. Like, that's not how these large vineyards operate anymore. So let's put this in the category of, you know, disappearing but not totally lost.
Okay. Now, you mentioned, just to jump into, like, Never Never Land, you mentioned people who had memories of dishes that nobody finds anymore, nobody makes anymore. Well, then they, I mean, but they remember the dish, so did you try to recreate them? Is there anything that you considered, or the person you interviewed considered totally lost, that you have tried to recreate and reintroduce?
Yeah, crapiata is a dish that, so it's from Matera, which I referenced before, this really like stone-hewn city of cave dwellings that was forcibly evacuated of its residents in the mid-20th century. And when people did live there, they would cook in their communal courtyards. People lived in caves around courtyards, and they would do a lot of cooking in these huge vessels. And crapiata was specifically a dish that was consumed around the end of harvest time. And people would get together and they would party and they would drink too much and they would eat this soup that was made of lots and lots of different beans, fava beans and other things as well. And then when people were moved to housing projects above the city, they didn't eat this dish anymore. Although they might have talked about it and reminisced about it, it lost its original location. And so it ceased to be produced in Matera.
Hmm.
But I'd read about it and I'd seen etchings of people simmering in these huge cauldrons. And so I would go to the market in Matera, which is in the sort of new part of Matera, and ask people about it and go to the dried bean vendor and inquire and sort of crowdsourced memories. And, you know, the dish that's in the book, the crapiata recipe that's in the book, is a sort of potpourri of people's memories.
Hmm. That's interesting. I'm sure it's one of those dishes too that every family or family group made it differently.
Sure.
Right? Depending on what they had on hand.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that was universal is like you made it in a gigantic cauldron. You do not need a gigantic cauldron or any special equipment for the recipes in this book. That's the good news. Cause the idea is like these things are vanishing or they've disappeared. So let's adapt them so that people can consume them and preserve
modern
them.
Kitchen. Yeah. But let's do talk about cauldrons, the cooking vessels for a moment. Those often for many of the old recipes were as important as the recipe itself, right? I mean,
for sure. They were heirlooms. People would pass them down through the matrilineal line. And it was an important feature of a woman's value all over the South to provide a fully stocked kitchen and a fully stocked collection of bed linens.
Part of her dowry.
Of course.
Or we would say hope chest.
Right? Sure, exactly. Better branding.
Yeah.
And yeah, the copper pot dowry was essential. And because so many of these villages have sort of similar approaches to preparing legumes and meats and things, there would be this sort of stock of copper items that would pass from one family to the next.
Mm-hmm. And then there would be terracotta. They did use terracotta.
Absolutely.
Pots, right?
Absolutely.
It was funny because I just was seeing a friend's posting of a wonderful large terracotta pot in Morocco that was being simmered over embers. I'm thinking, that doesn't sound too unfamiliar as far as a lot of southern Italy, long cooking stews and dishes, right? Yeah, interesting. Well, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about more of these disappearing and lost dishes and some recipes as well. So stay tuned.
Today's program was brought to you by Roth Cheese, a pioneer in the U.S. specialty cheese movement. Roth is in its 25th year of making specialty cheese in the rolling hills of southern Wisconsin. With strong Swiss heritage, Roth is best known for its award-winning Alpine-style cheeses under the name Grand Cru. Fresh Wisconsin milk, combined with expertise in affinage, is how Roth creates high-quality, great-tasting cheese year after year. In 2016, hard work paid off when out of over 2,000 contenders, Roth Grand Cru Sir Choix was named world champion at the World Cheese Championship. For more information, visit rothcheese.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Sari Kamen.
And I'm Leah Kurtz. And together we host Food Without Borders here on HRN.
Immigrants make our food system vibrant, diverse, and delicious.
Each week, we invite a guest to talk about how food connects them to their past as we explore what it's like to be an immigrant in the U.S. today.
You can find Food Without Borders wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, we're back, and I'm speaking with Katie Parla, and Katie has a brand new book out called Food of the Italian South. I'm going to get the last part right. The recipes for classic, disappearing, and lost dishes. Now, of course, it sounds like an oxymoron to say a recipe for a lost dish, but in fact, you have tried to recreate some of these dishes that are probably disappearing from people's, hopefully not their memories. I mean, that's the only way you can get them, but from their whole repertoire of cooking on a daily basis. Another dish that came to mind when I was thinking of kind of, you know, just disappearing dishes. People are so maybe adhering to recipes all the time. Well, we have to make, you know, the recipe. We have to make a puttanesca. We have to make, oh, God knows. You and I talked about in Rome, all the dishes were coming back from grandmother's, the cacio e pepe, the carbonara. But you have this cute and wonderful, it seems to me, tasting dish. I don't know. I didn't make it, didn't taste it, but I can't imagine how it could be bad. Garbage can pasta.
It's so good.
What is garbage can pasta?
Garbage can pasta, in Neapolitan dialect, sicchia da munezza, is a dish that is very typically made in and around Naples at Christmas time when Neapolitans cook so many dishes for Christmas Eve, so many dishes for Christmas. Sometimes they forget to eat, so they have to like whip something together really quick. And spaghetti made in sicchia da munezza style is like the perfect thing because it uses scraps left over from savory and sweet cooking. So it's kind of like puttanesca, like souped up puttanesca in a way, really fast dish. It's a tomato-based sauce with pine nuts, hazelnuts, walnuts, capers, olives, and raisins. Some people also use candied fruit and or anchovies. It doesn't really have a strict recipe because everyone makes it with whatever's laying around after food prep. Although the one that appears in the book is from a corti in Santa Anastasia, this wonderful trattoria that's been open since 1924. And it's Ange Ceriello's version.
Well, what could be bad?
It's so delicious. And, you know, I want people to look at this and be like, that's a really terrible name. Let me see how it tastes. And then they'll say, it's so delicious. This is going to be, you know, in my daily rotation or my weekly rotation. It's such a delicious thing.
When I saw it listed, I immediately turned to it to read more about it, thinking, well, it sounds like something I'd make when I go to the refrigerator. We don't have anything else to eat. We just get home from a late night, I don't know, or come back from the country and
totally.
Got to throw something together. No, it's not at all what I would have. This was totally different. I mean, the use of, you know, a little sweetness in there and then the capers with the nuts and some, you know, tomatoes maybe. It has a wonderful base. It has a wonderful,
it's so great,
wonderful taste. We have in the studio with us Claire Alsop, and if those of you who subscribe and follow, you'll remember that Claire was with me for a wonderful program on the anchovy sauce on Collatore di Cetara. And Katie, you've got a whole mention of the Collatore because it's an anchovy sauce that is, and I like what you said, it was like an elegant, or somebody else you would interview said,
garum.
An elegant garum. Yeah, you don't use the fish guts as we talked about. It's just pure anchovies and just that have just sort of emulsify. What are you not?
Some people call it an elixir.
Yeah, yeah, and
anchovy elixir
used drop by drop because, well, some people use a little more than that because they get used to it. But it is pretty pungent, and if you're not used to it, it has quite a lot of flavor. But anyway, Claire. Hi, Claire.
Hey, Claire.
You did a wonderful show on that. And so I thought it was interesting for you because you're familiar with the south of Italy, at least the Naples and Amalfi Coast area, and wondered if there was anything you wanted to ask Katie about the book that you thought might be interesting for people who might be thinking about the south and what your take is.
Yeah. Hey, Katie.
Hi.
So I was curious because I recognize some of these recipes from my time spent in Campania, but I know they're accredited to other regions across the south of Italy. And I'm curious how you chose the recipes and regions associated with them, whether it was based on the importance within the region or just your favorite interpretation of a dish and what the differences are between some of the region's recipes when they overlap a little bit.
So are there any recipes in particular that you're thinking of?
The moment they are escaping me because I was not prepared, but there was one that I think had a bread salad take on like a panzanella that I would...
Okay, it's called caponata.
Actually, I saw that too. Yeah. I was thinking, oh, it's a panzanella. Well, a little different.
Yeah, right. So caponata... C-A-P-U-N-A-T-A, not to be confused with Sicilian caponata, is like a frisella, which can be made with barley or various wheat flours. And it's like it looks like a bagel, but it's not a bagel. It's like a twice baked cookie bread.
A rusk, yes.
Rusk, hardtack, all that
stuff. That hard bread that you don't really know what to do with.
And it's like broken up into pieces and tossed with escarole, tomatoes, like whatever you got around. That is something that's so typical of like Puglia, but then you also find it in parts of Basilicata. Like, it's one of those things that does, I wouldn't say it travels, it's just there are a lot of places that use rusk, and one way that you still consume rusk today is by softening it with olive oil, a little bit of water, vegetables. So the components change depending on where you are, because this also goes for like the fillings of the swordfish roll or a lot of the bread fillings that are in the dish. The breadcrumbs are always in the mix, but then the other seasonings change depending on geography. It's a similar way, like you've got durum wheat pasta in Puglia and you've got durum wheat pasta in Basilicata, but the shapes that they take change depending on where you are often, because the produce or the items that are available as condiments change, and pasta shapes and sauces are meant to complement one another.
I think it's a legal
requirement, correct?
right. Try to explain that to people but you don't say it when someone serves you something totally inappropriate. You just kind of hold off till the end, another time. But that's interesting, yeah, that dish traveled. Actually, I noticed the swordfish rolls with the breadcrumbs inside. That's a very Sicilian
It feels
thing
so
as well,
Sicilian,
right?
But it's from Scilla, which is in Calabria. Hmm. And just to follow up on the second part of Claire's question, which one is the real recipe, which is authentic? I try not to really get bogged down with that, but instead root each head note, which is the text that precedes the recipe, gives a little background into the dish. And of course, you know, travel all over the south and you will find candele with nduja made one way in one village, and then every village between there and the next one has a different one, then you find almost an identical version. Like, there's no, these things aren't living in sort of a vacuum. So sometimes you find like pretty close to identical recipes at a great distance. And then other times you find things like manel, which is a cornbread fritter, formed by squeezing the sort of cooked polenta in your fist and frying it. Like, that's typical of the Sannio, specifically one part of the Sannio. And then you don't find it really in other places, but you do find cubes of polenta fried in Bari.
Hmm.
So
yeah, I was going to ask you
recipe, different form.
I mean, in general, how much cornmeal was used, I'm thinking, in the past, because corn was not grown as much down south.
There was so much trade going on, though. And there are certainly places where corn is cultivated in,
now,
in South
now
Italy.
It's a whole different thing, right.
And, you know, when corn started to be sort of mass cultivated, there would have been a lot of, there would have been many cornfields in the South. And now the demand from the 20th century onward has been for wheat flour, wheat berries and wheat flour. So particularly because pasta production has increased across Italy and globally. So there are certainly cornbread and polenta recipes in Puglia, definitely in Molise, things that really would be considered to Pugliesi or Molisani as like completely authentic. But because we associate polenta with the north, we forget that it really is part of some southern cuisines.
I had just seen recently a recipe for a corn meal, corn flour pasta. And I don't remember where I saw it, but anyway, I didn't know if you ran across anything.
Not that like I can that recall, sort. But I would totally eat that.
Yeah, I was wondering about that and how much it was used. Which brings, I want to talk about pasta and pasta shapes because everybody thinks pasta when they think of, certainly the south of Italy, but in Italy in general. And who doesn't love pasta, right? but first I wanted to mention something, and I was so pleased to see you had it in your book. It's come up recently with a couple of different chefs, or one in particular, and I forget who, and it was probably written about in some food article, food magazine. And that is the burnt flour that's
grano arso,
used to make pasta.
Yes.
Tell me about that, and because my question, the bigger question, is how much lore is this, like traditions and stories that you're never quite sure where, what the actual history is of a lot of this. But you have quite a wonderful background on the arso.
So here. Grano arso, which means burned grains, let's go to what the probable origins are. At the turn of the 20th century, or just following unification, as there was an increase in mechanization in fields in and around Puglia and Basilicata.
And owners of farms.
Of course, owners of farms have their lands dispersed. People were really, really hungry. So after the grain cultivation in June or July, the fields would be burned, which is the custom, and peasants would go collect the charred wheat berries and then mill them and make pasta. It's highly unlikely that they were not also mixing that with unburned milled grain, because it's very difficult to develop any gluten in charred wheat berries in pasta made from the flour of charred wheat berries. So most likely people weren't just eating like wheat berries that had been milled into flour and mixed with water to make orecchiette or cavatelli. They were just using a portion of the burned grain, which is reflected in the recipe. Now, after a time, lots of people left these rural zones, and grano arso ceased to be part of the cuisine, it seems, for decades, until the 80s or 90s, when chefs in Puglia in particular were looking back at old recipes and old stories, and they revived grano arso. Now there are many companies that sell grano arso already milled, so sort of burnt flour. Many chefs in Puglia, other parts of Italy to a lesser extent, and many Italian leaning chefs in America make orecchiette or other sort of small stubby shapes of grano arso. And what's really fun about this recipe is it comes from around Andria, where people were desperately impoverished and they made their grano arso pasta. And then in the 90s, the revival of this product is really like a huge resurgence. It becomes like this very posh thing to have, like grano arso or orecchiette. So they put like burrata on it. Burrata is a very luscious mozzarella like sort of like a mozzarella sheath filled with mozzarella curds and sort of a cream, and that becomes one of the toppings along with almond pesto in what we would call neo trattorias, places that are doing something which is modern but often looking to the
with
past
little,
for their inspiration.
A little hint to the or wink to the to the past. That's great. Well, I'm wondering, could you just toast the flour?
Yeah.
And, you know, you could toast. Yeah, so
you
I
don't have to.
I started thinking about that.
Harvest
just toast,
grain.
Yeah, toast.
And then burn the field.
I don't have to go out to the burnt field and but just toast the flour. I mean, it does give a real nutty flavor to a lot of things. I mean, toasted using toasted flour for roux and, you know, gravies and other things has been done forever.
I mean, yes.
So it seems that it would render a real nutty kind of flavor to
exactly.
things. Yeah, interesting. And the use of, well, the use of bread, there's bread, so much bread throughout. And mostly the Durum wheat bread. Durum wheat was grown throughout most of the area.
Yeah. There was hard and soft wheat grown all over South Italy to this day, although now because of the demand for flour for pasta, extruded pasta, Durum wheat dominates. But people 100 years ago, 150 years ago, were eating their carbs in bread form to a greater extent than they were eating in pasta form.
And you mentioned earlier breadcrumbs being used to even make pasta.
I mean, absolutely, yeah. And bread would be baked often in these communal ovens. People would bake, you know, not daily, but sometimes just weekly. So they would have to have a lot of recipes to make the use of stale, to make use of stale bread. That included sort of cubing the stale bread and baking it into casseroles, using it as filling or stuffing for meat rolls or fish rolls. There are lots and lots of stale bread uses in here. So I wouldn't recommend using any stale bread that you have. Like if you've got Wonder Bread or whatever, that might be like okay in the stuffing of something.
I give a little more respect to my listeners. I think they get it.
Wonder Bread tastes good, like with PB&J. Like maybe you've got Wonder Bread laying around and you don't want to chuck it.
Yeah, no.
Who knows?
Yeah. And pasta shapes. Is there any pasta shapes that you? I know they abound there every day. There's another pasta shape that comes up that I never knew about, and I don't know whether it's a new one or if it's, you know, it's an old one or only one person in the, you know, in the community made it. But any type of pasta shape that you attribute particularly to Southern culture, to the Southern culture of Italy?
It's a great question. I mean, I think cavatelli and orecchiette, and cavatelli in their various sort of lengths and, right. you know, if you visit Bari, cavatelli look a little bit different in length than they do in the middle of Irpinio or the Sannio. The names change, of course, for the pasta shapes. But the sort of short Durum wheats, flour and water pastas, those are really rooted in the South.
Mm-hmm. How about the pastas that are rolled with a thin steel, a metal?
Yeah, like the various type of fusilli.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And those can vary in length, too. You can use
not the fusilli necessarily, but the ones that are made with the metal rod that roll and you get...
They call them fusilli.
They all? In,
I mean, that's
in
the
general,
Italian...
Fusilli?
That's the Italian word for that long tube. Mm. But it goes by a huge range of dialect forms.
Interesting.
I mean, it's Italy, right? So
yeah.
Everything defies explanation when it comes to nomenclature.
And cheeses, of course, there are, as you were mentioning in Molise, all the animals running around, all the livestock. A lot of sheep, a lot of goats, a lot of cows. So there's a lot of cheese.
Don't forget the buffaloes in Campania too.
Well, naturally. Well, you mentioned the mozzarella da bufala, so you know that goes without saying. And that's talk about that.
Oh, mozzarella di bufala.
I'll talk about the water buffalo.
Okay. So there are water buffalo that likely arrived in the Middle Ages, perhaps a little later. There's scholarly debate over their origins and their exact date of arrival, but water buffalo, until very recently, grazed in the marshy, mucky swamps of Campania. And they were likely brought over for work. And someone discovered you could milk them and make cheese from their milk. And that cheese could be produced into something called mozzarella. It's pretty high fat compared to cow's milk mozzarella. It's super flavorful. And now the mucky marshes have been dried up, but the buffaloes still roam. In farms that vary in size. I always recommend that if you're going to the Amalfi Coast or to Naples, that you rent a car or get a driver and go to Vanulo, which is very close to Pestum. So if you're into archaeology, Pestum is amazing, and you can look at archaeological sites. But I would say go first to Vanulo because they only sell their buffalo mozzarella on the farm. They don't distribute it anywhere because they don't know what's going to happen to it when it leaves the farm, and they want you absolutely guarantee it's quality through temperature control. And part of the experience is going to like hang with the buffaloes. You see the pretty modern facilities where they self-regulate their massage and shower schedules, where they can hang out on rubber mattresses, which might sound absurd, but actually, if you think about it, buffaloes are very, very sensitive. Their milk production and the quality of their milk is influenced by their mood. And so when they're stressed, they can't make delicious milk. They don't want to.
Sounds reasonable to me. Well, Katie, we could keep talking about food and recipes and the south of Italy for a long time, but I encourage people to take a look at the book. And I enjoy talking to you whenever you come to town. You
Same.
Always have some interesting things to say. And again, Katie's new book is called Food of the Italian South, Recipes for Classic, Disappearing, and Lost Recipes. Okay, give me one last word. What was one of the surprise discoveries you made, or if any, and that was a disappearing recipe that you had to include?
I think one of the surprises was the sardines that were like layered in a saffron vinegar with breadcrumbs and aged in barrels in Gallipoli.
Oh, that sounds good.
It's really good.
But they don't age them for a long time. I mean, they don't want them to
disintegrate. No, they just sort of marinate them.
Yeah.
They kind of, well, depends on how long you leave them, but yeah. I've seen them in various states of preservation.
You eat them with a spoon.
But yeah, I've been to Gallipoli a zillion times and never had seen them until the past couple trips, so.
Interesting. Okay. Well, if you have now a hankering for some old-fashioned and historic recipes as well, definitely take a look. Not everything. There's not everything in the book. I mean, you got to go and...
Unfortunately, there aren't 850,000 recipes in the book.
Yeah, you got to go do some research yourself. But you certainly give a good idea of what these areas are like, how the production is still going on, and where production is still going on. And it's just a wonderful read. Thanks
Grazie.
So much. And thank you for listening to Another Taste of the Past.
A Taste of the Past is powered by Simplecast. Simplecast is a popular hosting and analytics platform that allows podcasters to easily host and publish to apps like Apple Podcasts. If you have a podcast or are looking to create your very first, check it out. Try it for free and save half off your first 3 months at simplecast.com/heritage.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like. Tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.